Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They've got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil, goes the old Sinatra song. Emphasis on old. Brazil has boomed and transformed in the last generation. Its name right up there now with Russia, India, China, coming on strong and quite independent of a U.S. agenda. Yes, it has poverty, inequality, crime, racism, says my guest today, but it is really on the move. And a lot of Americans need to catch up. This hour on Point, the remaking of Brazil. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the changes firsthand? Tell us. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we will look at the challenges, physical and psychological, facing the miners trapped deep underground in Chile. But joining me now from New York City is Larry Roeder, longtime South American bureau chief for the New York Times. His new book is Brazil on the Rise, The Story of a Country Transformed. Larry Roeder, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. My pleasure to be here.
You've been in and out and a lot of in Brazil for a long time now. 1972, your first trip there as a young guy.
Yeah, I almost hate to admit it.
Almost hate to write too long. That's, you know, that's 40 years and counting, Larry.
Yeah, right.
Or getting there. Give us a quick sense first of how you see, I guess, how Americans think of Brazil versus what Brazil has become, what it is.
Yeah, I think the classic images are carnival, the samba, the girl from Ipanema, the Amazon in flames. And all of that is real. All of that is part of Brazil. But Brazil has become much more than that, especially since the end of the military dictatorship in 1985. Over the last 25 years, as I say in the subtitle of the book, the country really has been transformed, both in a political sense and an economic sense. I think that it's the economy that really grabs the attention of people. Because Brazil has become an agricultural superpower. It's become an industrial nation. And as you indicated in the introduction, it's been promoted really by Wall Street from this category of third world country lumped together with a lot of the other of its South American neighbors into this somewhat elite group with Russia, India, and China.
Brazil, and Russia, India, China, BRIC, the BRIC nations,
the BRIC
they call it, and a lot of investment and anticipation of where they're going.
Yeah, huge amounts of investment in Brazil, both in industry and in agriculture. We can see the results of that. Brazil has become, perhaps the most important source of raw materials for China. So there's this triangular relationship where Americans are buying goods from China that are made from Brazilian materials, iron ore, wood. The Chinese look to Brazil for that. And soybeans, there's been a soybean boom in Brazil, largely to feed the Chinese middle class, to give soybeans to the pigs and the cows that the emerging Chinese middle class is going to eat.
So part of Brazil's boom is in a way China's boom, but it's not just these big resources, iron ore and wood and soy and coffee. And you're pointing out that a lot of Brazil's export face this now is highly industrialized. Airplanes,
yes,
for example.
Right. There have been some years in the last decade where the number one export item has been aircraft. The Embraer factory outside of São Paulo produces these planes that are dominate the commuter routes in the U.S. and Europe. For example, if you're flying from New York to Indianapolis or Chicago to Kansas City, in all likelihood, you're on a Brazilian aircraft. You may not know it, but they dominate that segment. And in 2008, when I was on the campaign trail with candidates here in the U.S., Sarah Palin traveled on an Embraer jet.
Who would guess it? I mean, you say people wouldn't guess it. Probably they wouldn't know it. They wouldn't even guess it if you asked where was your plane made.
Right.
But there it is. Fifth largest country in the world. The eighth largest economy now. Larger than France, I think I saw somewhere. And predicted to go up to maybe the fifth largest economy in the world. Growth rates somewhere projected around 7%. Do Brazilians know it? Do they know they're on a roll?
They do know they're on a roll. And they're really grateful for it, but worried that it might not last. I was with a Brazilian film director here in New York recently, and he was saying to me, you know, I'm 70 years old. Never in my lifetime has there been a combination like this of political and economic stability. And there's an election next month to choose a new president. And I think that people are aware that that's really what the bottom line issue is. You've got, for the first time since the end of the military dictatorship, neither of the two main political figures of this period are going to be on the ballot. It's new names, new faces.
So it's not Lula, who's just headed out,
right.
Or his...
Or Fernando Henrique Cardoso,
Cardoso, his predecessor. Two big guys not there at all, which means if they can make this, they're really into a new kind of era of transitions.
Right, exactly. They've reached this level that distinguishes them from anybody else in Latin America. But, you know, it's a big country. It's an ambitious country, a lot like us in some ways, you know, a nation of immigrants. And their aspirations, I think, go beyond being the biggest guy in the neighborhood. You know, they want to be a world player, a world power. And they talk of being the fifth power by the next, you know, middle of the next decade.
The fifth power, that is, after what, U.S., China, help me here.
I guess the European Union they consider as one entity.
Mm-hmm. India and then Brazil.
Yeah, India or Japan and then Brazil, yeah.
Wow. And that's as big as it gets. They are no slaves to Washington's global agenda, have been very friendly with Iran, very friendly with Venezuela, Cuba. Certainly, this is no imitator of Washington policy emerging here.
No, but the relationship has been cordial, really, since the return of democracy. Fernando Henrique Cardoso and Bill Clinton were very, very close. They share a common worldview. And then when Lula came in 2003, mm-hmm. everybody thought, well, you know, he and George Bush are not going to get along. Well, in fact, their personal relationship was quite friendly. They disagreed on a lot of things. But Brazil Brazil is driven in terms of its foreign policy, I think, historically by a desire to be friendly with everybody, to be the enemy of no one. And so the relationship is cordial with Washington, but also
arm in arm with Ahmadinejad in Tehran,
right? And that's, you know, that's caused some problems in the recent relationship. In Brazil, there was this feeling that when Bush left and Obama came in, that everything was going to suddenly be transformed and wonderful. But there have been differences. There have been quarrels. The crisis in Honduras was part of that, but Iran has emerged.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right, Iran has emerged as really the big dividing point, and it's controversial, the stance that Lula has taken. In Brazil itself, it's become an issue in this presidential campaign. What is our president doing over there, arm in arm with that lunatic? Why were the Iranian leaders given a Brazilian soccer team shirt? That's really going too far. But you know, this is part of Brazil's effort to become a player on the world stage, and there will be stumbles. It's a difficult learning process. We know that ourselves as Americans.
Well, but as you say, they want to be friends with everybody. They may just have their own way of looking at issues.
Right, right, right. I mean, me personally, I've been critical of the fact that they preach a strong support of human rights mm-hmm. around the world, and this is based on their own experience under a military dictatorship, but they don't want to vote against Cuba in UN condemnations of human rights abuses there. So there are, you know, there are contradictions.
Booming along in the last 15, 20 years, of course, it's not all paradise. You're very clear about that. Violence and racism, we'll talk about that. Crime, and we all just saw this, a gunman invading the Intercontinental Hotel in Rio just this last weekend, I think.
Right.
Kind of an eye-raiser, and a lot of inequality.
Yes. And the question of inequality is closely tied to race, I would argue. The country historically has really not done a good job of distributing wealth. There's been income skewed very much in favor of a small elite that is overwhelmingly white at the expense of the great mass of Brazilians who, for the most part, are black or brown. To their credit, the last two governments, Fernando Henrique Cardoso and Lula, have made an attempt to address that. The inequalities have been lessened, but there's still a long way to go.
Harder for the U.S. to point fingers on that front these days. You point out that, that Brazil shares with the U.S. a history of slavery. They had it before the U.S. They had it after the U.S. in a very complex racial culture having emerged from that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Rio de Janeiro.
Rio de Janeiro!
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the remaking of Brazil behind us right there. Sound of celebration in October last year when Rio learned it would host the 2016 Olympics, beating out Chicago, Madrid, and Tokyo. And a lot of celebration right there as that news came through. Larry Roeder has covered Brazil and South America for a long time. He's written Brazil on the Rise, the story of a country transformed, about just how far this country has come in the last 15 or 20 years since military dictatorship. We're going to hear a little later in this hour from Chile, where those miners are deep underground and are going to be there for some time to come. Physical challenges and psychological challenges there. Brazil, fifth largest country in the world, eighth largest economy now, and they've got oil and they've got alternative energy. They've got big ag challenging the U.S. In ranking, and they've got an election coming up. The current president has endorsed his hand-picked successor, Dilma Rousseff. Here's one of Rousseff's campaigns featuring Lula, the incumbent's endorsement, or ads here.
She has been very efficient in coordinating my government. I tell you without the slightest doubt, a big part of the government's success comes from Dilma Rousseff's ability to coordinate.
October presidential elections coming up in Brazil. Larry, there are a lot of current things I want to get to, but if you could, I wanted to ask you about the ways in which Brazil's history is like and unlike that of the U.S. It may help people understand what you're telling us about where the country has come to.
Sure. You mentioned slavery. That's been, you know, a stain on the history of both countries, but it started in Brazil 70 years before it began in the United States. It lasted for another quarter of a century after it was abolished in the U.S. And then comes, with the end of slavery, a shift to looking for labor force abroad. So there was a huge influx of immigrants from Europe. And that's in common with the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Also in common with the U.S., the conquest of the frontier. You know, we have our pioneers and the covered wagons and
cowboys.
Right. Well, they have cowboys too,
mm-hmm.
And they have what they call the flag carriers, who are the explorers who went into the wilderness, the jungle, and you know the same. You know, history of extermination of indigenous peoles as well. So we're talking really about two dynamic immigrant-based societies that feel that they have a unique historical mission, blessed by God. They have that in common. But there are, as you point out, differences too. religion. You know, it's Brazil is a primarily Catholic country, although that's changing. The racial mix is different. You could say the definition of racial groups is different in Brazil, but by our standards, the majority of the population would be considered non-white.
Well, let's look at that for a second, because I think a lot of Americans have had the idea that Brazil is a kind of racial, I mean, to some people describe it as a racial paradise where color doesn't matter so much, lines are blurred, you know, you don't have the same animosities because you don't have these sharp distinctions. But you say, yes, lines are blurred, but race awareness, color awareness, racism even, very much alive.
Sure. I mean, the Portuguese, unlike the English colonists, intermarried, or, you know, you get a mulatto population in a way that you don't get in the United States. Mm. But, you know, when that immigrant population started coming in, it really was followed by a neglect of the Afro-Brazilian population that only in recent years is being addressed. And there's racism in all kinds of aspects of daily life in Brazil. You know, just over the weekend, a mayor in a fairly large-sized city, he was boasting about some new services that the municipality had built, a clinic maybe or a school, I can't remember, a hospital. And he said, this is for white people. He was trying to say that this is high-quality stuff.
Wow.
But that kind of casual racism, you know, pervades Brazilian culture. It would be hard to imagine the mayor of Des Moines ever saying such a thing or surviving if he,
no
if
way.
He did.
No way.
Right. You know, Lula, when he went to Africa a few years ago, he arrived in the capital of Namibia, and his opening remarks were, it's so clean here, you don't think you're in Africa. You know, this is typical, I'm afraid.
Let's go to our callers. William in Spartanburg, South Carolina. William, you're on with Larry Roeder.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was really struck by the mention of soybean farming that's really starting to take on great notice in Brazil.
Yeah.
And there's a downside to it, and that one of the richest estuaries of rainforest is being wiped out because the land is being made used for soybean farming and such, and feeding the wealthy nations of the world. And so I think I'd like to hear your guests speak about how that's being balanced against this great world resource. And I'll take my answer off our air. Thank you very much.
Thank you, William. Yeah, booming agricultural production, and you point out, Larry, one of the few countries in the world where there's still fresh land to open up and farm. But of course, as William and many others point out, that can mean devastation to natural environments. Net positive?
Well, the challenge is to keep the bulk of that agricultural cultivation out of these areas of the Amazon. That can be done, but the government needs to do a much, much better job. The area south of the Amazon, a savanna that extends across the heart of Brazil, what they call the Cerrados, is good land for that. And that's where the government needs to be giving credit, not giving bank credit to people who want to cut down the rainforest and have cattle ranches or soybean farms. To me, the central problem is that the Amazon is so vast and so difficult to control that Brazil has fallen short, regardless of all the promises that it's made, because it just doesn't have the capacity. The inspectors, the boats, the trucks. Yes, it has satellites in the sky that can monitor and record what's going on, but down on the ground, it's a whole different story. That's an irony.
Do you really mean it's just a matter of capacity? I mean, you point to some of the sort of big, what you call baffling questions to outsiders about Brazil, and this is right at the heart of them. You know, why does, you ask, Brazil permit the wholesale devastation of the Amazon, and why does it so strongly resent suggestions as to how to reduce that destruction? You're saying they just don't have enough jeeps and trucks to go out there and stop it?
No, there's a political there's a question of political will as well. There are people who benefit from this. and they have power, and they don't, and they want to block any effort to bring this to an end. I think that the government has started to do a better job. You see the numbers on deforestation declining. They're not declining fast enough, and it's still a huge problem. But at last, I think there are signs that Brazil recognizes that this is a problem. And the traditional attitude has always been, this is the Amazon is ours. This is not your business. Keep your nose out of it. Mm-hmm. And that's still the predominant attitude. But I was heartened by what occurred at Copenhagen last December, where I saw some signs of Brazil shifting away from its traditional keep away position. And it made some pledges to reduce deforestation. Now, you know, obviously there's no monitoring aspect to this. It's just a pledge. But the previous posture of Brazil in these international forums had been obstructionist. Let's prevent anything from any mechanism that could break, you know, halt deforestation from coming onto the agenda.
So maybe some change there as they climb up the economic ladder.
Well, we have to hope so.
Let's go to Tony in Wethersfield, Connecticut. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, everybody. I just wanted to let you know that 9 months ago, my brother Paul, who was an environmental scientist, he and his wife, who is Brazilian, packed up and moved to Brazil. They're about 800 kilometers southwest of São Paulo.
Okay.
And he's loving it down there. He's working as a consultant for Hydro Brazil. He's saying to me that on their power generation and especially the material they use for cooling some of the transformers is a little bit even ahead of us as far as their concept and their the technology that they're using. And he and his wife live in an agricultural area, and it's kind of odd that you were just talking about deforestation, because there's a big campaign to plant trees in order to prevent the land from blowing away when they have some droughts.
We'll hope for that. But he's in the middle of Brazil's energy push, which has been very big. Tony, thanks for calling. Larry, both on the oil front and on the alternative energy front. Very big, Tony says, his brother says, maybe even out front of the U.S. sometimes.
Yeah, this is one of the things that's impressive about Brazil, is the way the country finds these niches to develop expertise. And that's one of them. Genome mapping is another. I mentioned the airplanes. The country doesn't have the capacity yet to do a full front kind of advance. So they've been smart in finding these niches. And, of course, to connect this to the energy question, ethanol probably is the biggest of these triumphs, dating back to the mid-1970s when people thought it was crazy. And now you look at the country and automobiles, you know, those millions of automobiles run largely on ethanol.
And not from corn, as so widely practiced here.
No, from sugarcane. And that's part of the irony of the situation, that the oldest crop dating back to the earliest days of Brazil should prove to be the mechanism by which in the 21st century Brazil becomes a energy player. And now, in the last 2 or 3 years, these amazing gas and oil finds offshore, off the coast of São Paulo and Rio, are already transforming Brazil into a oil exporter, a significant one.
The U.S. talks about energy independence. Brazil has it.
It does. And then hydropower is the third element. Rivers all over the country. Now, this is controversial, too, because this has to do with damage to the Amazon. The Belo Monte project right now on the Xingu River is the flashpoint for this.
Big dam. Mm-hmm.
Right, right.
They're moving ahead with it despite some
despite
resistance
there. Exactly. But ethanol is a different story. I know that there are people who have doubts about ethanol, both because of the issue of corn and also because they fear that it could be another mechanism to destroy the Amazon. But this industry is concentrated mostly in São Paulo, which is not Amazon. It's tropical or subtropical.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be the tendency over the next decade or so, that this is going to be a motor of development in the interior of the state of São Paulo.
Energy. Liz in Brookline, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Larry Roeder.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Larry. In May 2007, my nephew was murdered in Rio by a policeman.
Oh, gosh.
And I went on to find out that 15% of all the murders committed in Rio are actually committed by the police. As recently as June, the United Nations issued a report on the high rate of murders. And in May, I testified before Congress about the high rate of police killings in Brazil, along with Daniel Wilkinson from Human Rights Watch,
mm-hmm.
David Dixon from Amnesty International, and James Cavallaro from the Human Rights and Law Program at Harvard. It's interesting because it seems to me that Brazil, the government, the powers that be, the media, put this forward as if these killings are, you know, all in the name of being tough on crime. But in fact, the Brazilian police, and especially the Rio police, they're not really working on crime prevention. I mean, another interesting statistic is if you look at the number of people killed by police in the United States and the number of people arrested, the ratio mm-hmm. is 1 to 37,000. In Rio, it's 1 to 23. Not 23,000, 1 to 23.
Liz, thanks for your call. Our time is short here, but Larry, what should we make of this?
Yeah, this is a terrible problem, and I'm sorry to hear that it hit so close to Liz. It's
mm-hmm.
It's something that the country has a great deal of difficulty addressing, and Sao Paulo, I don't think, is much different than Rio. There have been some years when the situation is even worse in Sao Paulo. The police,
is it a human rights issue?
Is it a kind of
inequality control? I mean, we've seen the pictures of fancy high-rises right next to really impoverished favelas.
Yeah, the police tend to go into the favelas with guns out and indiscriminately shooting. But it also needs to be said that the drug gangs in those favelas who keep those residents of the favelas in a state of subjugation, they're incredibly violent too. And they come down from those hillsides sometimes and have shootouts on the street or threaten the mayor's office, tell businesses you better shut down or we're going to blow you up with grenades. This is an enormous social problem, human rights problem. It stains the image of Brazil.
Are they on a path to move beyond it, Larry? I mean, we watch the gangs of New York in movies from our history, but that kind of gang violence is in that scale history here. Now, do you foresee it being history in Brazil, or is it somehow baked in more permanently?
Oh, man, that's such a tough question. I don't even really know how to respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
In all these years that I've been going to Brazil and living there, I've seen things get worse and worse and worse. I don't know where the end of it is.
On the crime front, you mean?
Oh, absolutely. Violence and crime, it just gets worse and worse. And I think drugs really made things worse as of 1980 or so, when that became the motor that pushed all of this instead of things like the numbers game.
So the rise you're talking about, is it a vulnerable rise? Is it a permanent rise? You quoted a Brazilian asking you earlier, can we keep this up or not? What do you say?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I did an interview yesterday with a Brazilian, news organization mm-hmm. who said, okay, you talk about Brazil and the rise. Are we going to fall? I'm optimistic, but man, we have to keep in account these problems. They're not going to go away, and you can't hide from them.
But we're getting a radically updated view of this big neighbor to the south. Larry Roeder's new book is Brazil on the Rise, the story of a country transformed. He was South American bureau chief for the New York Times from 1999 to 2007. First went to Brazil in 1972, and what a road it's been since then. Larry, thank you for the book, and thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. It's been fun.
When we come back, we'll look at those miners trapped deep underground in Chile. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 33 miners are trapped over 2,000 feet underground in Chile in a gold and silver mine there. They've already been there for weeks near starvation, and it's clear now that they will be there much, much longer, maybe Christmas before they're out of their tiny safety chamber. We're going to look at their circumstances and challenges for a bit here. Here's Chile's President Sebastián Piñera on Sunday reading just a bit of a note from the miners.
estamos bien. Los 33 en el refugio.
All 33 of us are fine and in the shelter, he reads there. With us now from Santiago, Chile, is Matt Craes, reporter for Bloomberg, covering the trapped miners. Matt, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
And for some mining perspective on this, miners' perspective, we have with us as well from Harlan, Kentucky, Tony Oppegard, mining safety lawyer and former Mine Safety and Health Administration official. Tony, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And also with us from Oakland, California, Mary Roach, a science writer. She's researched the effects of isolation and confinement on astronauts and others, author of Packing for Mars. NASA is using its expertise to help Chileans support their trapped miners. Mary Roach, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
So, Matt, you're right there in Chile. What's the latest from the miners? What do we know about how they're doing?
Well, right now, there's the story has become a little bit lower profile. We're not hearing the miners' comments daily on TV. However, we know that they're now being given proper food. They're beginning to send them proper diets with calories of about 2,000 calories a day. At the beginning, they were in a stage of semi-starvation, so they had to be very careful, and we're just sending them very small amounts of water with glucose. So we're now beginning to move on in that process.
How big is the shaft that goes down this 2,000 feet to the miner? What's the diameter?
It's about 6 centimeters. It's a drill hole that's usually used to look at geological samples of the rocks beneath the ground.
And so they can pass regular food down there? It was liquid food at first when they had just come out of near starvation.
That's right. It's still pretty much liquid drinks, high-protein drinks, and things like that. The food is pretty much put into a small cylinder, which is then lowered through this tube, which is now encased. It's about 6 centimeters wide, and it's 700 meters deep. So it's an awful long way down there.
So 6 centimeters, that's just a couple of inches wide and 2,000 feet down. That's a long way. And how long? We're going to talk with Mary and Tony about this, but how long are people now anticipating it's going to take to bring them out?
Well, the president of Chile, Sebastian Piñera, gave the message that they would probably be out before Christmas. However, they wouldn't be out before the Chile's National Day. It's celebrating 200 years of independence on September the 18th. We've now heard that the health minister yesterday said the recovery, the rescue effort would take probably about 90 days from now. Once this wider drill, which they're beginning to install, is ready to start work on the weekend.
33 men, and how big is the space they're trapped in, Tony? Matt, excuse me?
They have access to tunnels of about 2 kilometers, and there's a very small refuge with some benches. The area is actually a larger area than we originally thought, because they have access to these tunnels. But they have very few things down there. There's no beds, for example.
So they can, and can they walk in those tunnels? They're not. So it's not really just a living room-sized safety chamber where they're trapped.
That's right. They have access to tunnels. They've been told to keep away from some areas which may be unstable. They were actually, when they were looking to escape themselves from the mine before they were discovered, they tried to go up a chimney, which was totally impeded with rock. There are some restrictions on those tunnels, but we hear that they're actually using the tunnels to sleep in because the small refuge in the mine is too hot.
Matt Craes, stand by in Chile. Tony Oppegard, you're listening to this in Harlan, Kentucky. You've got a lot of familiarity with mining. 3 or 4 months to wait, maybe not the tiny chamber, but still 2,000 feet underground. How does that sound, Tony?
Well, I think there's a lot of unknowns at this point and uncertainties, and I don't think that anybody can assume that those miners are all going to be brought out safely. I mean, there's sort of the assumption now, well, it's going to be 3 months or 4 months, but that's an unprecedented length of time. I have not found any confinement and rescues in mines that exceeded 25 days.
Was that in the U.S. or elsewhere, Tony, 25 days?
That was in China. In China is the longest one we know of. But, of course, this is a different situation, you know, with technology and, you know, the ability to pass things down to them, including food. But the problem I was alluding to at first is that you still have to get those miners out of the mine. And once they have a hoist, they have the hole drilled down to the down to where the miners are trapped.
They're
going to have to be brought out one at a time, and that's an awfully long distance, 2,300 feet, to bring a capsule up in a hoist. So you hope, for instance, you don't have any problems with the cable that, you know, they're going to hoist them up with, because if something would happen there, then, you know, you're going to have a catastrophe. The closest parallel we have to this is the Kew Creek accident back in 2002 in western Pennsylvania. And those miners were trapped 240 feet below the surface. It took a little more than 3 days to drill down, and they brought them up one at a time. But here we're talking about almost 10 times the distance.
How are you assuming that hoisting back up would work? You build a human-sized capsule that will fit in just the narrowest shaft that will accommodate a human being, and you one by one you pull it up that 2,000 feet?
That's correct. And, I mean, then they'd have to send it back down again and hoist it back up 33 times. And my understanding was just even sending food, and Matt would know this for sure, but I had read where it takes an hour just to send supplies down.
Matt Craze in Santiago, what do we know about, what are Chileans saying about their optimism that they can actually bring them up? And what about the rock that this is in? Is it solid enough that there's not risk of another cave-in in the rescue tunnel?
Has said that the it's that there shouldn't be any more collapses, rock collapses, rock slides, but they've been told to stay away from certain areas where that might happen.
What about the rescue shaft, though, Matt? I mean, once you put that down, it itself could be vulnerable, I suppose.
That's right. At the moment, the first drill hole, which is being used for everything, has been encased with a sort of metal lining, and that generally what that does is it stabilizes the drill hole. And they're just now doing that with the second hole, which would ensure permanent contact with the rescue teams.
How long does it take? How long does it take to put to send lunch down?
It does take about an hour or so to properly lower the cylinders down. It's obviously an awful long way, but what they're trying to do is with three holes they can continue doing all of these things. They can dedicate one hole to liquid and foods, for example.
Mary Roach, you're listening patiently there in Oakland, California. You hear Tony in Kentucky say this is perhaps unprecedented in terms of the duration of time spent trapped underground. Of course, it's not unprecedented in terms of duration of time spent in very tight quarters in space. NASA is, we're told, giving some advice to the Chileans at this point. What are your thoughts on the challenge here, Mary?
Sure. Yeah, it's an incredibly frustrating experience, and what happens in space when you're in an environment where you're stuck, you really are soaking in it. You can't slam the door and run away. The frustration tends to turn to anger, and anger needs an outlet. And now, when you're trapped in a situation with other people, you tend not to take it out on them because you can't get away, and it just makes the situation worse. You're also depending on these people for your survival, so you tend to. People in this circumstance, they do something that psychologists call displacement, and that is they tend to get really angry at, in this case, it would be people on the surface. You know, in space, it's mission control, or it's the nutritionist who made the food that you're eating that you don't like, or whatever it is. You tend to take it out on somebody who's removed from the scenario. The other outlet is yourself, and this is more troublesome because if you turn anger inward, you get depression. And depression has been a problem, particularly in the longer missions, like on Mir, where it can be an insidious problem. So the other thing going on, about roundabout, I'm told around the sixth week, you tend to see more of a, on crews on long duration missions, there's a tendency to withdraw, become less social, become territorial, sort of mark out your territory and pull away.
Here's a web comment from Zeno. Mary says, I personally cannot think of a harder way to make a living. And he writes, the idea of 4 months of being buried alive is unimaginable. So what kind of advice, Mary, is NASA likely to give Chileans about how to help support these 33 men so deep underground?
Well, it's really such a different scenario, because with space, you have these tremendously motivated people who have spent their entire careers and much of their lives planning and dreaming of this moment. So they are really focused on, they can at least focus on the positive side of seeing the Earth from space, of mm-hmm. the incredible accomplishment of being up there. So in this situation, you don't have that on the other side of the balance. And I think if there's any, and how do you provide any sort of emotional support? You can't lower down a therapist. I would hope that they, one thing that really is difficult for astronauts is the lack of the natural world, the feeling of, you know, the sun on your face or the wind on your skin or something green. In space, when they're doing experiments with greenhouses, they tend to, you'll see the astronauts sort of congregating around the plants and saying things like, they are our love. This was from a quote from Salyut way back in
wow.
the early days. So without any, I mean, maybe they could lower down some plants. I don't know. I can't imagine how do you help people through something like this.
It's tough. Corey in Norfolk, Virginia. Corey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I spent a couple years stationed on a submarine in the U.S. Navy, and the toughest thing for me to get used to was the lighting when we were underway for several months. I was wondering what these guys had for, lighting down there. Do they rely on glow sticks, or do they actually have fluorescent or some sort of power?
It's a great question. The toughest thing to be without natural lighting there on the submarine. Matt Craze, what about power down there? Do they have power? Is it dark? Is it lit? How is it lit?
There isn't a great deal of information right now about that. What we heard initially, they were using the headlights from a vehicle they had down there, which was used for the mining. To light up the place, and then that eventually they had to turn that off. They've now been told not to do that because it could cause air pollution, and that could be dangerous. So I understand that they are actually they're looking at sending down some lights if they haven't done already, but there hasn't actually been a great deal of information.
But there's not power from the surface to their 2000.
No, there's not.
Wow, that sounds tough. Tony Upagar, how do you picture the environment down there, Tony? You know this mining environment better than most of us. What do you picture? The, you know, is it likely to be wet or dry, echoing or silent? Could it be totally black down there?
Well, yes, it's totally dark except for the mining equipment, and mm-hmm. that would not be operational now. So each miner is wearing a hard hat, and they have a cap light.
But they've been down there for weeks, and presumably those batteries are dead.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Hopefully mm-hmm. that they are passing batteries down to them so they can keep their cap lights going.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be very hot there because I've been in a gold mine before. They're much deeper, for instance, than coal mines are in the United States. So I think when they sent the camera down, they saw the miners were all bare-chested. You know, mm-hmm. it's going to be hot, and they're going to be sweating. But, yes, it's going to be very quiet there. They're going to have to deal with that and the lack of light. Then they also have the problem, of course, of sanitation. And that, I think that would be a concern as well.
At least they've got a couple of miles, though. They've got a mile and a half of tunnel they can at least get away from waste, let's say.
And that's good. And the ability to walk around also is good. When we think of refuge chambers in the United States, we're thinking of self-contained enclosed structures where we have regulations where you have to have enough food and water for 96 hours, for instance. And my understanding in this mine, it's not a self-contained, like, steel structure. It's just a part of the mine that's designated as a refuge chamber where they go, but they're actually in the mine atmosphere. So one concern is also, do they have enough oxygen? Is the area large enough? Because as they use oxygen, they're depleting the atmosphere of it. And my understanding is they're also sending oxygen down to the miner, so hopefully that won't be a problem.
And hot from the heat of the earth at that depth. Mary Roach, we know notes are being passed up and down from family members. I mean, what message do you send to humans, men, in this circumstance?
I think it's the fact that they are sending communications from family members is that's really the best thing. That's what someone wants, and that is one of the coping strategies with space. And that is you have communication by radio, by email with the family, and that's number one priority in terms of emotional health.
Well, you all three open our eyes to the depth of the challenge ahead. They are there. Their fate still clearly uncertain, and tough days ahead. Our thoughts and prayers with them. Mary Roach, author of Packing for Space, joining us from Oakland today. Thank you very much for being with us, Mary.
Thanks for having me on.
Tony Opegard in Harlan, Kentucky, former Mine Safety and Health Administration official. Tony, thanks for your insights today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
And Matt Craves with Bloomberg in Santiago, Chile. Matt, we'll look for your reports there. Thank you very much for your time and insights today.
Thanks.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.